Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Do you feel daunted? I don't think you look remotely daunted.
Boris Johnson becomes the next UK Prime Minister, a divisive populist who looks and sounds a lot like Donald Trump. We get the view from backers like former British Defence Minister Michael Fallon and exhausted European negotiators. Irish MEP and Vice President of the European Parliament, Mairead McGuinness, joins me. Then...
There's nothing. They're wasting their time.
Mueller mania strikes in the United States as the former special counsel prepares to publicly testify. I speak with Republican Senator Pat Toomey. Plus...
Practices of retaliation are one of the, you know, are the first thing we need to tackle when we begin to tackle these sort of Me Too issues.
The women walking off the Google campus speak out against what they call a culture of retaliation.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London, where today the United Kingdom got a new prime minister. To no one's surprise, the favourite, former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, was selected by an inner circle of Conservative Party members. In his victory speech, he whipped up the crowd with his typical bombast.
I read in my Financial Times this morning that there are no incoming leader. No incoming leader has ever faced such a daunting set of circumstances, it said. Well, I look at you this morning and I ask myself, do you look daunted? Do you feel daunted? I don't think you look remotely daunted. And I know some wag has already pointed out that Deliver, Unite and Defeat was not the perfect acronym for an election campaign, since unfortunately it spells dud. But they forgot the final E, my friends. E for energise. And I say to all the doubters, dude, we are going to energise the country. We're going to get Brexit done on October the 31st. We're going to take advantage of all the opportunities that it will bring in a new spirit of can-do.
Unusual language and style for a British Prime Minister. A populist politician who fronted the Leave campaign during the EU referendum with what the New York Times describes as a loose relationship with truth or principle. Johnson won the leadership contest by a margin of more than 40,000 votes, which is a lot considering the selection process was only open to the party membership, some 160,000 people. That's just 0.2% of the whole electorate. And tomorrow, Johnson will enter No. 10 Downing Street as Prime Minister. Theresa May exits and the country faces not only an uphill struggle with Brexit, but serious tensions with Iran. So let's get straight to what this change at the top means with Michael Fallon. He's the former UK Defence Secretary. He backed Boris Johnson during the campaign and he's joining me now here in our London studio. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
I first want to ask for everybody, actually, who's been saying Boris Johnson bears a distinct resemblance in look and in style to Donald Trump. And President Trump today gave a speech in Washington where he called Boris Johnson Britain's Trump.
Really good man is going to be the Prime Minister of the UK now, Boris Johnson. Good man. He's tough and he's smart. They're saying Britain Trump. They call him Britain Trump. And people are saying that's a good thing, that they like me over there. That's what they wanted. That's what they need. What they need. He'll get it done. Boris is good. He's going to do a good job.
Is that what you've bargained for? You who are a backer want a British Trump?
Well, not necessarily British Trump, but to have somebody who's already an ally of the president, has a good relationship with him. I remember the very first time I think they met at a NATO summit just after the president had taken office. You know, they made a beeline for each other. They clearly get on well. When Boris was foreign secretary, they worked well together. That's important to us in Britain, to have somebody who works well with your president, whoever your elected president is.
But people have pointed out that he's very much like Trump, in that Trump has played the, you know, divisive card. You've got the racist tweets, you've got the anti-immigrant sentiment, you've got the populism that has become sort of de facto in politics today.
I think, with respect, we've got to be careful about this. Boris, for 8 years, was mayor of London, one of the most ethnically diverse cities around, and was very much a social liberal in our terms in the Conservative Party, and was an early adopter of some of the gay rights legislation and so on. So I don't think he's like your president in that respect. But yes, he's populist, and yes, he's an optimist. And you heard that in his acceptance speech today. He is very much somebody who sees the best of Britain and thinks we can get through the challenge of Brexit and find a new role for ourselves in the world.
I just want to pick you up a little bit on this point, and then perhaps you can put it to bed. You know, Boris Johnson has used words like pickaninnies to describe Africans. He's talked about Muslim women in their traditional garb looking like letterboxes. I mean, he's talked about Barack Obama when he was president having an historical ancestral dislike of Britain because he was born to a Kenyan father. Put to rest, then, these fears Sure. about Boris Johnson and these kinds of things he says.
Well, I must be careful how I do that, because Boris Johnson, of course, was a journalist. And in saying that to you, I've got to be careful. He was a colourful journalist. He's been using for 20, 30 years colourful language in his journalism. But that article, for example, on the rights of women to wear the burqa, he was actually standing up for that right, if you read the article. He uses colourful phrases. He's apologised all along in this campaign for anybody who might have been offended by his previous journalism. But that's what he is. He was a journalist. That was his stock in trade.
You know, I hate again to pick you up again, because he was a journalist and he got fired for telling some lies about stories and misquoting people. And people have said again that this is a very, very important time. And as I quoted the New York Times, his relationship with the truth and with principle is somewhat sketchy. And, you know, the big emblazoned figure on the bus during the campaign was total nonsense. It wasn't a true figure. It isn't happening. What he said about Turks wanting to invade Britain was a nonsense, very inflammatory stuff. So I guess I'm asking you this, not just to pick at him, but to know how he's going to unite a country, how he's going to work with people and politicians from Europe and the rest to actually, you know, achieve something that this country needs, and that is a proper Brexit deal and a proper exit.
Well, I'm not going to go back over all the individual phrases that he used when he was a journalist. And during the referendum campaign, whether we should stay in the European Union or not, there were claims and counterclaims made from both sides that probably didn't stand up to excessive scrutiny, if you like. But I think the point about Boris Johnson is he also has solid senior experience in public office, running the City of London for two consecutive terms for 8 years, being Foreign Secretary for 2 years, alongside me as Defence Secretary. We shaped the coalition with the help of our allies, including the United States, to fight Daesh, ISIS terrorism in the Middle East. He stood up to Russia, if you remember, the Salisbury poisonings. This is a man who looked after the British interests when the going got tough.
Do you worry, though? I mean, you rightly point out that he was Foreign Secretary when you were Defence Secretary. I mean, you've seen all the articles, you've seen the Foreign Service officers who've talked about the day he resigned a year ago as Liberation Day in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. I mean, they called him unprepared, gaffe-prone, unfocused. Are you concerned about that, given the massive nature, as we've seen over the past 3 years, of trying to secure a Brexit? Are you concerned about that? How will he do any different than what Prime Minister May did?
Well, diplomats, I think, are always concerned about language and words. That's their stock in trade. I think every foreign secretary we've had, and who knows, perhaps some of your secretaries of state have tripped up occasionally with the odd slip of the tongue for which they've had to apologise, because these things sometimes do matter in international diplomacy. But when it came to the really tough decisions and some of the operations that he had to authorise, some of the steps had to be taken to protect us from terrorism. I have no doubt at all that Boris Johnson was then and will be a very serious defender of the British interests. Now, he's not the same as Theresa May, quite clearly. She was a very different political animal, if you like, a lot more introverted, very shy, very dutiful, but very different, obviously, to Boris Johnson.
So what magic sauce will he bring to this mix that suddenly makes Europe say, whoa, there's a new prime minister who's saying we're going to be out, deal or no deal. We don't want the backstop. We don't want this deal that Theresa May negotiated painstakingly. What is he going to do? What is he going to offer? What's different?
The big thing that's different is that Boris Johnson is a Brexiteer. He believes in us leaving the European Union. Theresa May didn't. She voted Remain. There's no sin in that. I voted Remain. But Boris Johnson is a Brexiteer. He believes in this. He thinks there is a future, a strong future for Britain outside the European Union. So he's bringing ambition and optimism and energy to this task. Mm-hmm. And he's also will be trading on the fact that Parliament does not like the present deal that was negotiated by Theresa May. Parliament wants a better deal. It's not just Boris Johnson who wants a better deal. Parliament itself would not accept the inferior deal that Theresa May presented it. So he's going to go out there and get us a better deal.
So, of course, everybody wants to know what will the ingredients of that better deal be and how will he do a better job of getting the Europeans to agree to a better deal than Theresa May. And to that point, I'd like to read from what the former party leader and former Foreign Secretary William Hague has written in the Daily Telegraph. He said, you know, you have consistently advocated an improved deal with the EU, but you've steadily made that pretty much impossible to obtain when you ruled out changes to the Irish backstop last week and insisted that it must be removed altogether. You dismayed some of your advisers and delighted others. But the delighted group are those who believe that the EU will back away completely from the withdrawal agreement that they spent 2 years negotiating in favour of something you like, and Hague calls that fantasy.
Well, already you've seen today the European leaders welcome the election of Boris Johnson as our leader, saying they're ready to sit down and work with him. They want to avoid, by the way, no deal. They want to avoid a disorderly exit.
But Boris says deal or no deal, do or die.
Yeah, of course, but he's had to say that to make sure they understand that we're serious about this. But there are neighbours particularly, Ireland and France and Belgium and Netherlands, who'd be particularly hurt by no deal. They don't want that either. So everybody will be sitting down to see, OK, can we improve this? Particularly as Parliament wanted better arrangements for Northern Ireland, and we don't want to be trapped in something that looks like the existing customs union forever. So there are ways in which this language can be improved and that we can get something that will get through Parliament. But you can only do that if you really believe in it. And Boris Johnson does believe in it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm impressed by your faith and his faith and his optimism. Sure. But this is a very difficult, I don't need to tell you, negotiation that's been going on for the better part of more than 2 years. We talked about President Trump and the need to have a strong relationship between the leaders of both countries. Former Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown was in the studio this week, and he was concerned that what appears to be egging on Boris Johnson to take the American view come what may, and to, you know, somewhat make Europe a second party. Let's just listen to what he said.
I think Boris Johnson is under a huge amount of pressure from his own Brexiteers, those people who are very hardline anti-European, and they would prefer to see an even stronger relationship with the United States, even if it's based on effectively taking instructions from President Trump. So I think he is under a great deal of pressure in that respect. But I do feel that he is going to have to show that he is also independent. And I think this will be the test of the first few days. For example, you know, when you become prime minister, you have calls. They go in a row. Who do you call first? Who takes the call first? Is it going to be President Trump, or is it going to be Angela Merkel, or is it going to be Emmanuel Macron?
Well, he was discussing the first days in office. So what does Boris Johnson have to do to prove that he's not going to, quote unquote, take instructions from the United States? You know, we know that he threw Kim Darroch under the bus because President Trump wasn't happy with what Kim Darroch said. That's what the Foreign Office says. That's what Darroch and his people say. That's what the commentary is. It's a touchy situation now.
Let's just roll back a bit. He's already proved that he doesn't have to take instructions from President Trump because of the stance he took on Iran, if you remember, when he was Foreign Secretary and America decided they wanted to withdraw from the nuclear agreement. We didn't go that way. Boris Johnson has defended the European agreement because he believed at the time that actually it was the best way of delaying Iran's nuclear program. So there's already a difference of view between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. And there will be other examples of where, as a good friend and a strong ally, the British Prime Minister occasionally will disagree with the American president.
Do you think he will actively, as Theresa May advised, actively try to lobby President Trump to get back into the deal or some version of the deal? Would you support that?
Well, I think there's going to have to be, I think the Americans are already open to some form of renegotiation of that particular agreement. I think John Bolton's already made that clear. And you've seen what's been happening on the international waterway since. We've lost one of our tankers that's been captured. So in the end, somebody is going to have to renegotiate with Iran to bring some sense into this situation, which is fairly dangerous at the moment. But the point I'm making to you is it does not follow that Boris Johnson will automatically do what the president wants. He still believes that it is better to have some form of agreement with Iran over its nuclear program that buys us all a bit of time.
So we introduce you in this segment right now as being amidst a Brexit struggle, and but also a crisis, as you've just pointed out, in the Gulf. You're the former defense secretary. What does the new government do to get back the tanker, to resolve this situation, presumably diplomatically?
Well, diplomatically, but I think we also have to show Iran that these were crimes. To sell oil to the Syrian regime, which is what is alleged, is a crime. But to take one of our tankers out of Omani waters is also a crime. These are criminal acts, and they can't be accepted. So we will have to divorce this from the nuclear program and make it clear to Iran that we'll have to take extra steps now to protect the international waterway with a multinational task force, which I hope, by the way, will include the American Navy and American support, but will also include ships from other European navies.
So you see it getting more tense? Well, more of a build-up?
It's getting more tense. Now, everybody wants to de-escalate it, but that shouldn't excuse what Iran has done. And we shouldn't allow, you know, our concerns about Iran's nuclear program or the survival of the agreement to in any way excuse what Iran has done or the need to protect our oil and gas supplies through that particular strait.
The Iranian foreign minister reached out to Boris Johnson saying that Iran was not looking for conflict. Is that something that you would welcome?
Well, it's a strange way not to look for conflict by capturing one of our tankers and refusing to hand it back. So, you know, this is, I'm afraid, a very tense situation at the moment. Obviously, we don't want to escalate it, but equally, we will have to start properly patrolling this international waterway.
Very interesting times. Thank you very much for weighing in.
Pleasure.
With this new leadership, the new Prime Minister, and now we're going to get the view from Europe. So, while Boris Johnson has overwhelming support from the pro-Brexit Conservative Party membership, the European Union is going to be a little harder, perhaps, to win over. The EU and Boris Johnson have a storied and troubled relationship. At a press conference, the incoming EU chief, Ursula von der Leyen, and the French President, Emmanuel Macron, reached out to the future British Prime Minister with talk of future challenges.
I am willing to work closely with him, not only on European issues, including the Brexit negotiations, but also on international issues, on which we are tightly coordinated, specifically with the British and the Germans. Could it be the Iran situation or any international security issue?
I'm looking forward to have a good working relation with him. There are many different and difficult issues to tackle together. We have challenging times ahead of us.
So what is in store for the future of this relationship? Mairead McGuinness, the Vice President of the European Parliament, joins us from Brussels. Ms. McGuinness, thank you very much indeed for joining our program again.
Good evening.
Good evening. Well, you heard what Boris Bakker and former Defence Secretary Michael Fallon just said, that the EU is going to see an energised, optimistic Boris Johnson, can do, and hopefully you will all be open to some kind of renegotiation or opening where you weren't to Theresa May.
Well, I think the first part I'll accept, the second part not so. I think it's welcome that there is a new leader in the United Kingdom who talks about energy and all of these strong words, which makes the people feel good. I think leaders need to do that. I think when you come then to the Brussels issues, I think the incoming president of the Commission, Frau von der Leyen, is very clear. There are huge challenges ahead of us. So today is a day really to wish the new leader of the United Kingdom, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, well, because he has a lot on his shoulders. But I think it's over time we'll see what can happen in terms of the relationship between the European Union and the United Kingdom and on the difficult issue of Brexit. I think it's quite interesting. The language is very sharp and very clear. But on the other hand, sometimes the clearest of language is the most opaque, because this idea of getting Brexit done suggests that once and for all, finito, we can do it on a day and move onwards. But in fact, we all know that that is not the case, that with a withdrawal agreement that is acceptable, we can move on to the implementation and we can get to the new relationship. With a no-deal Brexit, which is the do-or-die scenario, if you like, in that case, there will still be issues to deal with after there is a departure with no deal. And I hope I'm making sense. So this is a very complicated process. We just have a new leader elected in the United Kingdom, and we have to wait and see what will happen when, I suppose, there are files read and issues to be dealt with, both domestic, which are quite, you know, serious international issues like Iran, and clearly the relationship with the European Union. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here in the European Parliament, we've been getting on with our work, but people are talking about needing to have a good relationship with the Prime Minister, whoever it is. And I think it's one of the very key points, and I need to stress this, is that regardless of whose name is over the door, and there is a change now from Theresa May to Boris Johnson, the facts and the issues remain the same. The approaches might be different, but we have to still deal with the very issues that the Prime Minister, Theresa May, in all good faith, she worked with us on those. And indeed, she had to turn corners when she realised that her commitments, for example, to Northern Ireland, to the Good Friday Agreement, could not be dealt with if she kept her very red lines that she announced at the Tory party.
Right. And I wonder whether you think
the deal on the table reflects her concerns.
I wonder if you think, and I'm going to play a little bit of Boris Johnson's sort of explanation and reach out to the EU and to his own party, obviously, whether he may have boxed himself in as well. So let's just play this for a moment.
We're going to get Brexit done on October the 31st. We're going to take advantage of all the opportunities that it will bring in a new spirit of can-do. And we are once again going to believe in ourselves and what we can achieve. And like some slumbering giant, we are going to rise and ping off the guy ropes of self-doubt and negativity.
Well, some might call that highfalutin rhetoric. How do you read that? Ping off the robes, achieve Brexit, can do. I mean, he did actually say the other day that if 50 years ago one can put a people on the moon, then surely one can overcome technical difficulties to monitor the Irish border. Do you see it that way?
Well, before I address that point, the line that stuck out for me in the clip you've just played is where Boris Johnson is saying to the British nation, we have to believe in ourselves again. What troubles me is, when did Britain and the United Kingdom stop believing in themselves? I mean, that's quite a staggering statement from the leader of a country, and that he believes that overnight he can change that dynamic. I would hope that the British people, who are a very proud people and a big nation, have self-belief. I think we all need that as nations and as peoples. Then to your question about his analogy with space and the Irish border and mixing these things up, you know, perhaps getting to the moon is simpler than dealing with the complexities of relationships between people that have been strained for decades, where we've built a peace process that is still delicate but working, and where we need as people to continue that process and not put obstacles in its way. So I think that the colourful language is great and it makes great headlines. And the one thing I have in common with Boris Johnson is that I too was a journalist. I think perhaps the difference is that when I moved and was elected to politics, I dropped all my journalist friends. I don't believe I'm a journalist now. I'm a politician. I have the interests of people at heart. I'm not here to make headlines. If I do that, that's separate from the work I do. And I think that perhaps the new Prime Minister, with all the huge responsibilities taking on, he wanted this job, I think, more than anything else. He now has it. And I'm wondering in private and quiet moments, if he gets them, will he look in the mirror and say, my gosh, I've achieved this, my dream, but I want to make sure it doesn't become a nightmare. And therefore, we all have to work together on Brexit to make sure that if it's going to happen, it does it in a very sensible and coherent way, and that it doesn't damage any of us, either the United Kingdom or the European Union. And the truth is, it will damage us a little, all of us, but we have to minimise that damage, and I hope we can work together and achieve that.
Well, so let me ask you this. You say we have to work together in sort of a collegial way to achieve something that's to all of our benefit. But the former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown told me yesterday that Boris Johnson has, quote, promised UK voters that he will not pay dues to the EU. That is a real problem for the EU. If we're breaking that agreement, it looks effectively like a declaration of economic war. I mean, that's not a friendly collegial thing to say, as he's, you know, about to try to enter negotiations with you.
Well, look, lots of things are said in the heat of battle. And I think those amongst us who hear all these things and write them down, just reflect quietly on them and then deal with where we're at today. If you take that case of a hard Brexit and pulling away from commitments that were entered into in good faith, I think that will, if you like, hit back more on the United Kingdom as a nation that is trying to go off on its own and build relationships, perhaps, with the US and elsewhere, and it will need to have a reputation that it respects its agreements. That's very important in global relationships. And the idea of walking away and not paying the bill, I think, wouldn't look particularly well. And I'm not sure that advisers or indeed the Prime Minister would like it to be presented as that. At the end of the day, the European Union of 28 came together voluntarily, including the United Kingdom. You've made a decision now, the UK has made a decision to leave, but we have to do it respecting each other. We also have to respect the rules of the European Union. We are now going to be a club of 27. We don't want to change our rules because one is leaving, but we do want to try and have a very good relationship in the future with this country that will still be very close to us physically and otherwise, we hope. But it is not going to be the same as full membership. So my worry about the events of today is not so much that we have more negotiations, but the timelines are very tight. There will be a Tory party conference, I think, on the 29th of September. And then there is to be this D-Day of Brexit again, October 31st. And then there is the August recess. So in terms of getting down to, you know, dealing with each other, understanding each other, going through the details of the withdrawal agreement, perhaps explaining it more in detail to the Prime Minister, there isn't a lot of time to do all of that. And I think I already met, you know, sectors today, for example, from the equine industry, from Northern Ireland, from the Republic of Ireland, from across Europe, who are deeply concerned about Brexit happening in a very disorderly way. And they're just one sector. There are others that will be, you know, watching and waiting for all the commentary of today and tomorrow and the next days, trying, if you like, to understand what will happen. And here's the rub for all of us. 3 years ago, when the UK voted to leave the European Union, no one would have predicted a change of leader, a lengthy process, U-turns along the way, different red lines, you know, all sorts of things that happened. No one would have predicted that today we would have a third leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And there is not one of us, and me included, who can predict the next steps, even if they are only weeks away.
Indeed, these are very tricky times. Thank you for trying to guide us through them. Mairead McGuinness from the European Parliament. Thank you so much indeed. Boris Johnson hopes to offset Brexit with an ambitious trade deal with Washington. It's something President Trump, who's long favoured Johnson, has repeatedly hinted at. But easier said than done. And it is hardly the top of the president's agenda right now. What with a racist row dragging on with four congresswomen of color and the hugely anticipated public testimony of Robert Mueller before Congress tomorrow. Joining me for more on all of this is Senator Pat Toomey, Republican from Pennsylvania. He's been one of the few in his party who isn't afraid to criticize the president. And he's joining us now from Washington. Senator Toomey, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Can I just ask you first, since I'm just sort of making a connection between our previous guests and yourself over the issue of Brexit, but most particularly the relationship of Britain going forward with the United States and a possible preferential trade deal. Now, we heard President Trump today praise Boris Johnson, calling him Britain's Trump. He said everybody over in Britain likes me, and that's great because, you know, Boris is like me. But I want to know whether you think it's in the president's purview to carve out, you know, this preferential trade deal that the Brexiters and Boris Johnson think that they can get?
I think it is. I think it would be very, very good for the economies of both countries to have a free trade agreement. And it is something, as you point out, that the president has alluded to. I'm not aware of a lot of progress being made on that front, but I have encouraged the administration to pursue exactly that.
About this trade deal between Brexit, Britain and the United States, there is a major issue here that's very close to the U.S., and that is maintaining freedom and the integrity of the peace agreement between Ireland and Britain and the freedom of that border. And I spoke to Nancy Pelosi, leader of the House, just a few months ago about this, and she laid out how a trade deal with the United States would be intricately linked with this freedom and the integrity of the Good Friday Agreement. Just take a listen, sir.
It's very hard to pass a trade agreement in Congress. Very, very hard. And it won a U.S.-U.K. Trade agreement that would be a reward for weakening of the Good Friday Accords is just not a possibility. But maybe they can accomplish it without doing that. We just wanted to make sure they understood that as a consolation for leaving the EU, they're not getting the U.S.
Senator, do you agree with that, that there can be no rewarding of Brexit Britain if Northern Ireland and Ireland and the peace agreement is put at risk?
Well, I don't think of it in terms of rewarding England for or the U.K. for Brexit, but I do agree that American lawmakers will take a very, very careful look at the status of that border. Obviously, we all remember all too painfully how tragic and how difficult that history was and how remarkably successful the Good Friday Agreement has been. So this, of course, is very much on the minds of the Irish and the Brits. And it's one of the challenges in negotiating a deal with Brexit. It would certainly be one of the challenges that we would have. But I wouldn't preclude the possibility that we could work out an acceptable solution.
All right. Well, let's turn back now to what's really taking up all the oxygen, or at least a lot of it, I think, in Washington. And that is tomorrow's planned public testimony of the former special counsel, Robert Mueller. Just tell me where you stand on this. Are you glad he's coming to testify? Do you think there are any questions that still need to be answered? Where do you stand on this?
Well, so first of all, there's a lot more interest in this among the media than there is among my constituents and probably among many senators. You know, I don't think we're going to learn very much. Bob Mueller has said that his report speaks for itself. He had to be subpoenaed in order to come. I think he's probably going to stick pretty closely to his report. And our Democratic colleagues are going to try to make a big to-do over a obstruction of an investigation that was not obstructed into a crime for which there's no evidence that there was a crime committed. So I'm not terribly curious about it. We'll see what happens.
So I just want to ask you how you reconcile yourself with this from the Mueller report. I mean, we've heard it over and again, but it still bears repeating. Mueller's report said, quote, "If we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state." Well, they didn't state. Does that not give you some cause for whatever, discomfort?
Not really, because they went through the litany of the behaviors that some people find objectionable, and I don't think they rise to the level of obstruction of justice. I think it's very clear. Bob Mueller finished his report. He finished his investigation unimpeded. He had dozens of lawyers, hundreds of witnesses, all the time in the world, a huge budget, and nobody stopped him. Mm-hmm. He finished. So his report is what it is. It strikes me pretty clear there was no obstruction of his investigation. And as I say, it's pretty clear there was no underlying crime committed as well. So that's why I think there's this is mostly politically motivated.
So regarding the idea, because I think you do all agree that Russia has played a very nefarious role in your democratic process, and you've said the special counsel's findings are a stark reminder that Russia's goal is to undermine the trust of the American people
right.
in our democratic process. Are you confident that this administration is doing all it can to stop that kind of interference and behavior?
I think actually there's been a lot of good progress made on that front. Yes, I totally believe that the Russians would love to disrupt America's political process, our elections. They want to discredit our model. That's the real ultimate motivation for Putin, in my view. Discredit it and weaken our institutions. If you look at the 2018 elections, I think it's pretty clear they didn't have much success, if any. And I think we have created a more robust process. So I do feel good about where we are. I'm sure they'll continue to try to be disruptive. But we're aware of that now and better able to defend against it.
So can I ask you, as one of the very rare sitting senators in the Republican Party who do distance themselves from the president on issues where it matters to you, you've talked out against the racist tweets against the women of color in Congress. You've also talked out against using emergency funds for the border wall. And you know this is going to be addressed by the Supreme Court next week. What do you think of the case to stop those funds being used for, you know, the border wall? Do you support that?
So I think the president has the funds at his disposal, the funds that he needs through a perfectly legal fashion to add to the border wall that he wants to build. And by the way, that the Border Patrol says we need, as you may know, we have several hundred miles of existing physical barriers, including walls. And our Border Patrol folks say that we need several 100 miles more, not the entire 1,900 miles by any means, but additional physical barriers that I think every one of the last at least half dozen or so presidents have added to. I think the president is right to wish to enhance that physical security. My position on this has always been that he should simply use the funds that Congress has authorized for that purpose. And it is enough to accomplish what he has said he wanted to accomplish. That's the way the president ought to do it.
So, Senator, latest Gallup poll shows some 90% of the Republican Party obviously supports President Trump. In other words, basically, the party has become the party of Trump. You've got dissenting senators who've either resigned or left politics or are doing other such things. Do you ever feel any pressure to tamp down your criticism on issues?
I don't. The way I look at it is I was elected separately from President Trump. He's the president of the United States. I'm a senator from Pennsylvania. And if I think that the president is advocating a policy that's not good for Pennsylvania or for our country, I think I have a responsibility to stand up and articulate an opposing point of view. I've done that on trade very, very consistently, and I will continue to do that. You know, the president has put together a coalition. He has a support, very broad support among Republicans. You're absolutely right about that. But there's a lot of Republicans that are still asking questions about some of the individual policies. I think people look at the overall economic thrust, and we have the best economy of my adult lifetime, literally the best economy in 50 years. And I think that it's clearly attributable to the president working with Republicans in Congress on rolling back excessive regulation, reforming our tax code. It's been terrific. And I think a lot of Republicans across Pennsylvania anyway say, hey, you know, the results have been really good.
Senator Toomey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thanks a lot. We turn now to Silicon Valley, where internal activism is brewing turmoil for big tech. Allegations of sexual harassment, gender inequality, and racism sparked a global walkout by 20,000 Google employees last year. Two of its leaders were Claire Stapleton and Meredith Whitaker, who both worked at the company for over a decade. They say they were sidelined for speaking out, telling our Alicia Menendez that Google needs to be held to account. Here's their conversation.
What drew you to Google? And then when did you realize that your expectation of what it would be was different than some of the realities?
Yeah. So I used to work on a weekly event that happens at Google, hosted by the founders, Larry and Sergey, or it used to be. And that is, it is a cultural hallmark of Google. We talk about what happened during the week, answer questions from employees. It's this incredibly optimistic, it's a profound cultural experience for people who come to Google. And I used to be at the side of the stage every week watching this and just think, I am at the best company in the world. This is the most progressive workplace, the most forward-thinking. We are changing the world. And that carry through a lot of the different roles that I had. What really changed it for me was in the fall of last year, there was a huge bombshell story about an executive payout that had been made to a known sexual harasser at Google. It was on the order of $90 million, as reported. That was incredibly disappointing. But what it sparked was women telling their stories at the company.
Mm-hmm. To each other.
To each other, yeah. Specifically, I was on an anonymous moms list where moms discuss everything that's going on at home and at work. And people started sharing their stories of different discrimination experiences they'd had, sexual harassment, talking about their very profound, very personal reaction to the story that we were reading in the news. Because it wasn't really about Andy Rubin and the sort of huge multimillion-dollar payout. It was about the injustice and unfairness that a lot of women were experiencing every day. And it inspired me to say, let's register our dissatisfaction with management. They hadn't addressed it in a way that I felt had urgency and accountability, that showed us how this wasn't going to happen again, that showed us how change was going to happen in the organization. And together we set out to walk out. And that next week we did. And it was, I think it was 20,000 people?
20,000
people in 40 offices. Yeah.
What were the stories, what were the range of stories you were hearing from other women about the conditions they were facing at work?
Yes, I think it was everything from I reported sexual harassment on my team and my manager protected the guy and I ended up having to transfer teams. That was incredibly common. It was almost an archetype that came out. I heard a lot about people raising their hand and saying something isn't right with the way with our diversity and inclusion practices on the team or the way people are talking to each other. It doesn't feel safe to me. I heard a lot about opportunity discrimination, that it's a boys' club, that the best projects are given to the manager's friends, the VP's friends, the best opportunities that are cherry-picked for the favorites. I heard generally that people don't have a lot of faith in fairness and opportunity. I think people in general have an expectation of fairness and opportunity in their workplace, particularly at Google, which, again, I'd had a really rosy and positive view of the workplace for a long time.
You know, it all gets to sort of abuse of power, right? Who has power and who doesn't? And ultimately, if someone in a position that didn't have power was harassed or racially discriminated against or discriminated against because of their gender identity, etc., it was way, way too often they were ostracized. They were sort of seen as the problem. And the people who did have structural power were, you know, ultimately, I think, in almost maybe not explicitly encouraged to do it. But you know, if you're not punished for it, if you're sort of, you know, if you never see any consequences, that is an implicit endorsement for that kind of behavior and those types of power structures. And I think this is something we need to get to the heart of, right? Who wins from this type of behavior?
You released a joint letter internally to the company speaking out about the culture of retaliation. Claire, you wrote, "My manager started ignoring me. My work was given to other people, and I was told to go on medical leave even though I'm not sick."
Yeah.
What happened?
So in January, 2 months after the walkout, I had a conversation with my manager where she laid out what was clearly a demotion. I would be layered, my team would be split in two,
Did you recognize it as retaliation at the time?
I didn't. I mean, it crossed my mind because she mentioned the walkout in this. She suggested a new project for me, working on YouTube Kids. And I asked her, why would I want to work on YouTube Kids? And she said, oh, I thought you'd be interested in that because of the walkout. And I said, help me connect the dots. What's the connection there? And she said, you know, women's issues. So it was clearly, I think, top of mind, even though it also was just sort of a clumsy communication. But what happened in the following few months was I was just trying to have my questions answered. I was so confused after years on this team, highly established, a strong performer, always, you know, increasing my scope, expanding my role on the team. All of a sudden, it was a huge setback. And as I asked these questions, the more isolating and strange the situation got. And in fact, the more that I was able to connect my story to the stories of so many other women who described retaliation when they'd spoken up about something that was happening in their workplace.
The letter concludes, "If we want to stop discrimination, harassment, and unethical decision-making, we need to end retaliation against the people who speak honestly about these problems." What was it you were trying to achieve?
Well, I think we needed to call out one of the primary barriers to ending racism misogyny, sexual harassment, and abuse within the workplace. There's Nicole Porter is a legal scholar who wrote an essay in the Stanford Law Review that makes an extremely compelling argument that actually practices of retaliation are one of the, you know, are the first thing we need to tackle when we begin to tackle these sort of Me Too issues, this sort of massive, the ongoing issue of persistent sexual harassment and discrimination within workplaces, you know, in tech and well beyond. And that the fear of speaking up, the, you know, legitimate fear of speaking up, the personal cost, the, you know, cost to your career and your livelihood that retaliation, you know, retaliation creates is a huge problem that means that, you know, I think it's no accident that a lot of the big Me Too stories are stories that are told about incidents that happened years before. These aren't people coming out and putting themselves at risk within their workplaces. And what we saw, you know, when Claire and I came forward with our stories, it was just like a dam broke. We have, you know, hundreds of stories of people contacting us saying this happened to me.
And what were you hearing? What were those stories?
Well, you know, all sorts of things, but they share, you know, they share some key features. One, you know, you begin to be isolated. You begin to be sort of iced out of conversations. You begin to be, you know, suddenly people who are warm or friendly turn cold. And so the environment you're in changes suddenly. You're taken off projects. You are told that you're not doing well.
Right.
Yeah. You are, you know, are you too sensitive, too negative, you know, not performing well? All of these things, you know, a kind of form of persistent structural gaslighting where you're told that, you know, the day before you were doing well, suddenly you bring a problem to the attention of management and you are the problem.
Right. By identifying the problem, you become the problem. How does that then function for someone who is a contract worker?
Well, that functions, it's sort of a double layer of vulnerability, right? Because, you know, Google now has over 50% of the workers at Google are contract workers. These are people who don't have the privileges of full employment. They don't have health insurance. They're often paid, you know, kind of subsistence wages. They don't get to report directly to Google's HR system. And the power asymmetry between contract workers and full-time workers is significant. So they are extremely vulnerable to these practices. And you see, you know, this is in issues of sexual harassment and abuse, but also issues of racial discrimination, issues of other forms of discrimination that happen persistently to contract workers, because if you look at the racial makeup, if you look at the gender makeup of Google's workforce, you know, you will see, you know, there are I think Google's workforce is 4% black people, the Google's full-time workforce. And you see in contract workers, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. I don't know that they're reported, but it is far, you know, you will see many more women of color. You will see many more black people in the contract workforce than in the full-time workforce. And you see, you know, very technically, like using this term correctly, you see a sort of pattern of structural racism where those at the bottom are, you know, the people who are most vulnerable are also more likely to be people of color and women, and the people with the most privileges are much more likely to be, you know, men, white men often.
Claire, tell me about your ultimate departure from the company.
I think that when we went out with our stories, we knew that we risked our jobs because this is how retaliation works. I think that we knew that we were speaking up for people that felt like they couldn't risk their jobs. Ultimately, I found out that I was pregnant in the spring, and I had been going through such stress and isolation. I think that the medical leave anecdote in my statement, in my story, really sums up how crazy making sharing your retaliation can be. Because ultimately, I was raising a serious retaliation claim to the highest rungs of the company, and the only solution that they came back to me with was not, let's figure out a way to make sense of this between you and your manager, find you a new team, transfer you somewhere where you can thrive. This was, you must declare yourself sick and unable to work. And I really sat with that. I really consider that. Am I crazy? Am I the sick one? Is the fact that I'm speaking out, am I as problematic and as crazy as they say, right? So I've been tremendously bolstered and encouraged by the network of women and men that have formed around the walkout. But ultimately, for my health and sanity and for my family, it made sense for me to leave.
Meredith, you're still there, which is almost more unbelievable.
Yeah, I persist. I will be there until I can no longer do my job with integrity. But I will say it's very difficult. I will also say that because my work is sort of focused outside of Google and has been for many years. This is, it's not an uncommon arrangement in the tech industry. But I co-founded an independent academic research institute called AI Now. And so I do spend a lot of my time, you know, there and talking with people who are outside of Google about serious research questions related to AI and ethics.
But at some point you were told to abandon that work.
I was. That was the sort of form that the retaliation took. And there's a term in labor law, labor parlance, called constructive discharge. And this is when, instead of firing you, saying, you know, Meredith, you're out, they just make it impossible for you to stay. So you have to kind of fire yourself, right? And, you know, this is recognized in labor law because it's not an uncommon practice. But in a sense, telling me I have to abandon that work, which sort of, I have built my reputation, I've built my career, I formed a research institute with Kate Crawford looking at these issues. We have long-term grants. We have a staff that has moved from around the world to work with us. Telling me to abandon that and take on what was effectively kind of a project management and administration job that was looking at very different things like balancing the budgets in a given department was a form of a fairly significant constructive discharge.
The things that you're saying about Google are very serious. Back in April, the company said this in response. We prohibit retaliation in the workplace and publicly share our very clear policy. To make sure that no complaint raised goes unheard at Google, we give employees multiple channels to report concerns, including anonymously, and investigate all allegations of retaliation. The company also said they did an investigation and saw no evidence of retaliation. Mm-hmm. So how do you respond?
Yeah, I mean, They said that. I would love to understand then what happened to my role as after not just, you know, 4 or 5 years on this team as a, you know, a high performer and, you know, rising star, but 12 years of a solid track record of the company. The first time this had ever happened to me where my role had been set back, diminished, where I felt like I could no longer talk to my leadership without fear of further retaliation, happened 2 months after the walkout. And that to me seems as clear as day. I don't know, you know, that so many of the stories that came out from the walkout and beyond to the many people that Meredith and I have connected with over the past few months in starting to share our stories have shown that actually Googlers don't have a lot of faith in these systems. They don't have a lot of faith in the investigations that get done, in the HR people that they seek for help, in the executives that they ask to help step in and figure out situations that don't feel right. This isn't just about me and Meredith. We knew that we weren't just the only two stories out there. And in fact, when we went out, we were emboldened by knowing we were speaking on behalf of many others.
Why not sue the company?
Let's be clear. These claims are extremely difficult to prove. There's some very, very, very bad case law and sort of labor protections that have been whittled away over the years to make it, you know, it's difficult to prove that suddenly I was gaslit. Suddenly my workplace was so hostile, I got sick coming in every day. We were hearing reports like this, right? And one of the trickiest and most difficult things about retaliation is that the company never admits that it's retaliating. So that statement was written by, I'm sure, a very competent lawyer, and that's exactly what you would say if you wanted to, you know, shore yourself up against any legal liability. But it's simply not true, right? And it's not true in our experience. It's not true in hundreds of people's experience. And this gets into this sort of systemic issues with HR. HR is there not to protect workers, right? They aren't your union. And, you know, I think we do need some kind of collective worker solidarity that can protect us against these things. HR are there to prevent the company from being liable for these harms. So the reason you have to watch all those deadening training videos about, you know, sexual harassment compliance that have over 30 years shown that they do nothing to affect this problem. The reason, you know, they have these sort of reporting structures and the reason they're set up the way they are is to protect the company from legal liability. That's what HR does, and they actually don't want to help you bring a case.
I mean, it's now been months since the walkout. Were there any successes that you can point to?
Yeah. I mean, Google ended forced arbitration, not just for sexual harassment, but across the board. Now they did that for full-time employees. It's still unclear how that's going to affect the majority of workers who are contractors. Google has also put in place, you know, a promise to increase benefits and give things like health insurance, have a minimum wage for contract workers, which is also, you know, contract workers have been organizing since then around, you know, demands for, you know, dignified work and, you know, reasonable benefits. Those are the two big kind of bulwarks. And I think one of the other successes that isn't specifically Google meeting the demands is just how much the organizing has grown. And now we have a really, you know, kind of a fabric of organizers within the company who are taking this very seriously and sort of beginning to take ownership for the environment that we work in and beginning to make, you know, clear demands to leadership about what we as workers need.
I think what's most shocking is that this is the company that sets out to solve the world's biggest problems. And we acknowledge that what we are raising with the walkout is really broad, systemic, deep issues. However, we've seen no imagination, no ingenuity to tackling these problems. The woman that they appointed to really respond to what employees are raising left the company a few months later. So clearly, this is not quite being given the resources and urgency, the honesty, the accountability that we're really asking for. However, lots of wins, and we are so pleased to see how the community has grown.
Yeah. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
So you heard Meredith Whittaker tell Alicia that she'd stay at Google until she could no longer do her job with integrity. Well, since that interview was taped, Whittaker has quit, saying, quote, "It is clear that Google is not a place that I can continue this work." Now, that is it for us. Remember, you can always listen to our podcast and see us online at amanpour.com. And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.